afternoon. Skadrin has another obligation today with the university, so I will be covering lecture for today. He should be back next week. So last time here, we finished going over makefiles and started talking a bit about permissions and access control. When we went over makefiles, we talked about kind of ways to avoid or repeating ourselves in makefiles. We learned about sort of basic make rules and how to write them and how they were actually run. But this kind of gets tedious with a large project where we're kind of writing the same thing over and over again, and that's pretty annoying. And make had some ways to help us avoid that. So one of these ways is what's called macros or variables, where we can have a setting typically at the top of our make file and use that sort of setting multiple places. You know, typical setting would be like the name of our C compiler or the options to pass to our C compiler or the names of libraries to use. Things that we might want to use multiple places in a make file especially would be something we'd put in these settings. We also talked a bit about pattern rules. So our rules for like producing .o files from .c files, they all look the same. But when we originally learned how to write rules, it looked like we had to write down for foo.o, bar.o, maz.o, if we had all these C files, all these rules to write that are basically the same. And it turns out we can write one rule that specifies all of them using this pattern rule syntax, where we use a percent sign to represent the stem, the beginning of the file name, and make will automatically know how to apply that for, you know, multiple different files that match that pattern. And we also saw that we could do this trick where we would say, you know, we would have an extra rule that just gave the dependencies, and when make saw two rules for the same thing, would merge them together for us. So we take the pattern rule and mix it up with this sort of separate thing specifying the dependencies. So we could still, for example, have a pattern rule for .o files that says the .o files are built from .c files, and also specify different .h files each .o file needs. You know, that wouldn't be something we could put in the pattern rule because it's, you know, changed for every single C file. Then we started talking about permissions. And permissions are like when you open a file or try to do some operation, depending on who you are, it's either allowed or disallowed. And one thing we need to learn is like, how does the operating system know whether a program is allowed to do something or not? And we learned that the main mechanism for this is that the OS is going to track extra information for every process, that's every running program. And the form that information takes on Unix is that we'll have a user ID and some group IDs that are going to tell us what things that program is allowed to do. And when that program's accessing files, we're going to match this up against what we called an access control list. And we have kind of two types on a Unix system. We have the type that works everywhere, these chmod-based permissions, where our access control list specifies a user who's known as the owner of the file, and whether they can read, write, or execute it, specifies one group, and whether processes that belong to that group ID can read, write, or execute, and a default for a process that doesn't fit any of those categories. And we learned that we could sort of set these as a number with this chmod command. So you could do chmod, you know, 751, for example. This would be user rwx, group rx, and other x. That would be an example of permissions we could set. Does that make sense to set? I don't know. Or we could use this other syntax of saying user permissions rwx g equals rx equals x to set that. And I'm writing chmod because that's the actual command you can use to change these settings on your files. We also learned a kind of about a more general mechanism of the sort of more generic, in the sense of work, you know, do more stuff, access control list, where we just specify a list of users and groups, and we can have not just one user who has to be the owner who controls the file, but we can have multiple users, not all of whom are the owner of the file, and multiple groups, and set the same settings, read, write, execute for each of them. And then we briefly talked about super user or root. So often we're going to want to have the system administrator have extra access, and we're going to see some reasons we're going to want that more today. And the way Unix handles that is that we have a special user ID 0, that basically just has a special case and all the permission checks. So if we think of the chmod or access control list permissions, we have some code. The kernel, sort of the open implementation, has some code which is going to be like, if, you know, the chmod stuff okay for the current user, then allow access otherwise. And basically all these permission checks are modified to actually say, I should do this color, if the user ID equals 0, or, so we just ignore, we don't care what the chmod stuff says if it's user ID 0, we just allow it. So questions on these things we covered last time? Yeah? What exactly is a group? What type of group would access a file? So typically, group IDs are used to represent a group of users who have sort of some administrative reason they're grouped together, like Scott gave the example of his research group. Like he has people he worked with, so we'd arrange for the system administrator, put them all in one group, meaning that when they log in, their programs run with a group ID for that group. And this means that you can make files that everyone in that research group can access this way. So that's kind of the most common and most natural use of groups, but the system administrator can use them for whatever they want. You know, it's, the OS is just comparing group numbers. So some other uses might be if you like want to give certain users access to, say, a printer, you have a group for the printer, and you make it so their programs run in that group if they're allowed to print, and other users' programs don't run in that group. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so one piece of administrivia. If you've looked at the schedule or remember from last week, we have a quiz that will be due next Tuesday before this lecture. And we have a quiz system that is my fault. And I'd like to show you how it works. So I'm going to show you a demo quiz website that's not our quiz website. Our quiz website is linked from Canvas. This is a demo website, so the questions aren't the actual questions that are on this week's quiz. And you're going to go to a quiz. It's going to actually ask you to confirm that you want to open it, but I already opened this one. And then you'll get to a page like this, and you'll have questions you can answer. And when you select an answer, the box around the question should turn green. If it turns green, your answer is recorded. If sometime later you answer the quiz, go back, and sometime later you don't like that answer, you can go back, you can change your answer, and whatever answer you have recorded last, that's what we're going to rate. You can also type some comments in here. This question is ambiguous because you used the word build and that doesn't mean anything. You can write some comment, and when you click out of the box, that comment's saved. If the box turns green around it, so in this case I clicked out of the box to save the comment, and we will eventually read these comments and decide whether to adjust your grade. I would encourage you, if you're writing comments, to not write a comment like this, which doesn't tell us what you thought the answer was based on what you thought was unclear. But if you think the question is unclear, please make your best guess about what we meant and explain how it affected your answer in the comments, and we will take that into account when grading. I usually won't be able to give clarifications on the quiz, because if you tell me something's wrong with the quiz on Saturday and I give a clarification, then I'm being really mean to people who decided to do the quiz on Friday as a sensible planning strategy. I tell them, too bad, sorry for doing the quiz early. You might need to look at this. So what we're going to do instead is we're just going to deal with the question as written. If the question is not answerable, we'll just drop it. If the question has extra answers, we'll accept extra answers. And we can have questions which are the select all that apply. We can have ones where you write some words, or ones where you select a single answer. Yes?
This is not related to what you're saying, but for the first one, is the answer to B, C, and E?
Is the answer to this B, C, and E? Which one should we use? So if we modify utility 2.c, what should we rerun? Yeah, we should rerun that. We need to rebuild utility.c. We need to rebuild the library that contains utility 2.c. And we actually don't need to rerun E, because remember, it's loaded at runtime. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Is there a time limit?
No. You can go back to the quiz as many times as you like, up until the deadline, which is going to be 15 minutes before lecture. Yeah?
Does it show you if your answer is right or wrong?
Does it show you if your answer is right or wrong? Not until the quiz is due. Also, it shows you automatically when the quiz is due, so we normally can't do extensions. And we'll figure something out if you're sick or something, but like normally, if it shows you the answer right, it's hard to tell you, here's have an extra hour. Other questions? Yeah. Is the quiz time? No. Okay. So let's go back to talking about, so we mentioned the idea of super user last time, and we mentioned that it's different than kernel mode, which we're going to talk a little more about, that the sort of special mode for the processor, because it's not the case that programs running as super user have directly more access to the system. It's just the case that rather than having the OS say, no, you can't do that, the OS just says, that's fine, even if there's an access control list which says it shouldn't be. So let's go and talk about some kind of issues with setting up our user and group IDs that we've kind of skipped over, and one of them is sort of logging into a machine. So if I walk up to a machine that just booted, I need to type in a username and password, and I say, what's going on here? And typically, this is going to be a program I'm just typing input into. And the program just is capable of checking if the password's correct, changing the user IDs, and running a shell, the program that implements the command line. So there's a bunch of parts of this. So let's talk about checking if the password is correct. How does that work? And kind of the way Linux and Unix work is that just like the core part of the OS, the kernel, doesn't know about usernames, it only knows about IDs, it doesn't know about passwords. Doesn't actually know. Yeah?
There is a file called UTC Shadow, and it uses a hash algorithm to hash the password, see if it's correct against the hash that's in that password file, and then that returns.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, sorry. Yeah, so the solution is that the sequential solution for a single user system is what she described, which is there's a special file that is only readable by root that has the passwords in there, typically hashed, because we're concerned about people extracting the raw passwords. But the important part is it's only readable by super user slash root. And that's fine, because we're going to have our login program running as super user. So it's going to have access to that file. On the department machines, this is not actually what we do, because we want to have the same passwords across every machine. So there's actually a network database that sort of gives us access to passwords. And because the way we're checking passwords is just that we're like doing stuff with files or doing stuff with the network, we can easily change how passwords work. That we just need to replace login with a different program. We don't need to update any other part of the OS. And we can switch to, like, instead of having you enter a password, having you plug in a physical token that has some unique ID on it or something, or having you use a fingerprint scanner. That's all just changes that don't involve changing the core part of the OS. It's just one program you need to change. So then we need to do this operation of changing user IDs. And I told you that programs have a user ID, and, you know, they have one user ID, and it's not something you can normally change, because we don't want you to log into Portal and run just start running stuff with my user ID. That would kind of defeat the point of being able to have files that are only accessible by me if you could just do that. So on Unix, there's a library call called setUID, which is probably what login uses. And the reason why this is okay is that this call sort of is only really powerful if you're a super user. So if you're a super user, this sets the effective user ID to whatever value you pass in. If you're not super user, it's probably going to fail. But if you are a super user, it sets the effective ID to that. It also, in fact, turns out it sets a whole bunch of other user IDs, because there's some extra user IDs stored with the process. We'll talk about why in our next topic. So it sets all of them to the specified user ID for a super user. So this means that when we go to our next step, which is starting another program, that other program is only running with your user ID, so it doesn't have any access it's not supposed to, even though we initially started it as this super user that has all sorts of access you aren't supposed to have. Okay, so questions about the set user ID part? So we can think of the login program as just giving up all its special access before running your shell. So for this login program, this is kind of relatively straightforward, because we know at boot it makes sense that things would run as the system administrator user. But some of you who've used and administered Unix-like systems might be familiar with some things where this model doesn't seem to make sense. And the biggest example is something called sudo. It's a very common utility, and where the idea is that if you're a system administrator, you can run sudo in some command, and it will run it with extra privileges. It actually runs it as user ID 0. And it doesn't just let you do this automatically. Typically, it asks for a password. But a problem here is that we know that when you start programs, they don't start as super user. They stay with your user ID. Kind of the default way user IDs and group IDs work is that you only have user IDs and group IDs you start with. You don't get extra ones. So what's happening here to make set sudo an exception? And we know we can't just call this set user UID call to like go back to super user, because, you know, if we could do that, so could a program, you know, you write and compile, and that would not be very safe. So something needs to be special about sudo to make this work. And what's going to be special is that we're going to set a special bit on the file. So the file for sudo is going to have this sort of metadata bit, kind of like our permission bits, but kind of alongside them, called the set user ID bit. And what this is going to do is going to make the system call the exact, this is the start program, system call, when we run an executable that's marked as set user ID, it's going to change the effective user ID to be the user ID of the owner of that file. And sudo is going to be owned by root, super user, so it's going to change it to user ID 0. And I mentioned we have these extra user IDs. This is where they become useful all of a sudden. Because one thing sudo needs to do is it needs to know whose password we're typing in. So it needs to know what user it used to be. And because we have some extra user IDs with our process, those user IDs are not changed. So those will tell sudo when it runs what user ID started sudo, even though it's running with the access of root. So we change the effective user ID so it has access to check passwords, to call set UID and change user IDs. But it uses the sort of other user IDs associated with the process to learn, okay, who's actually running me. And the sudo program sort of has its own code where it, you know, checks, oh, is the original user allowed to do this based on the configuration of the system? If so, like check the password, run the command, otherwise just print an error. And because this was installed by the system administrator, we hope it's okay, whatever the sudo program does. If there's a bug in the sudo program, well, too bad. Now you can do stuff you're not supposed to. And I mentioned we have this set user ID bit. You might say, how do I set that? So it turns out you can set it with the chmod command. U plus S is the way it's set. I believe on the department machines, it's disabled for your home directories because it can make things insecure if you set it and don't know why you're setting it. But it's just a thing we can set with chmod in addition to our normal permissions. So questions about this set user ID idea? Yeah. So the question is, why can't you just use sudo on portal? So the sudo program, it's sort of code, basically, it follows this sudo code here. If the original user is allowed to do it, do the thing, otherwise don't. And this is the original user allowed is basically it read a config file, which I think is like etc sudoers, and check for an entry listing this user. So if that check fails, which it will on portal because you're not one of the system administrators, then sudo is just going to return an error for you.
So then what advantages would sudo give you if you're only going to do that if you think that you would otherwise be allowed to do anyways?
What advantages do you think sudo give you if you only can do things you are otherwise allowed to do anyways? You aren't otherwise allowed to do them. Right, so if you pass this check, if you're in that list, you can do things that your programs couldn't do otherwise because this is sudo is running with super with the super user.
So there's stuff that like you can only do if you're in sudo, even though if your user ID is allowed to do certain stuff, but only if you're in the sudo program.
Question: your user ID is allowed to do certain stuff, but only if you're in a certain program. I would put it a different way. Your user ID is not allowed to do certain stuff. And you can run sudo, which is allowed to do everything, but sudo like will only do things for you if it's written to do that. And the way sudo is written is it's written to do only what it's configured to do for you. So sudo has the capability of doing whatever it wants as far as like, as a program that's run with the set user ID flag, it can do anything in the system because it bypasses all checks. But the only things it will actually do for you is what it's configured to do because it has this if statement. So as a system administrator, what you do is you say, if I want the user to run certain commands with super user privilege but not other things, I can configure sudo So we'll let them do that, but only those commands I specify, for example. And that's because that check, that if statement there, you can have the config file specify what things you want to allow. Does that answer your question? Question, why would I need to use sudo to do something if my ID already has permissions to do it? If you're a system administrator of a system, it's typically considered good practice to typically run with a user ID that is not root, even if you're supposed to have root privileges. And the biggest reason for this is that if you make a mistake as user ID 0, you can mess things up for everyone. If you mistype an RM command, usually the worst you can do is mess up your own files. If you're doing it as root, you mess up everyone's files. So typically system administrators don't want to run most of their programs with full permissions, even if they have that access to the system. So even if they have access to run things as super user, they don't want to do it most of the time. Yes. Yeah. Other questions? And I guess something I get at is often set user ID programs are gonna let you do selective things. So with sudo, like it seemed kind of silly because I can put sort of any command here, it seems like. Why wouldn't I just run as root? But the most common use of set user ID programs is to let you do things that you normally can't do in a more selective manner. So for example, on my laptop, which runs Linux, I can plug in a USB stick and mount that USB stick so I can access its files. That operation normally requires superuser because just the way the kernel is programmed, just manipulating what disks are available is reserved for system administrators only because you can do things that really mess up the system that way. But we want to mount USB sticks for normal users. So what they've done is that there's a standard program that most system administrators install that will just mount USB sticks, which it needs super user to do because we're manipulating these what disks are available, and that's dangerous. And any user can run that program, even though it needs to do stuff that requires super user. So there's a program I can run to mount a USB stick, it runs as root. It doesn't let me run anything, it just lets me mount a USB stick, and that's okay. Similarly, often we'll want to have a program you can use to print. And one way we can implement that is we can have the program be set user ID to some user that can access the printer, that has permissions for the file that represents the printer. And a reason we do that is that that program can make sure we only send things to the printer that won't break the printer or won't print a million pages. And it can implement those sorts of policies for us. There's also some other operations we might imagine being restricted to certain users, and we can kind of use this idea where set user ID programs give us selected access to that functionality. So these are all things I might want to let normal users do that normally require me to be root. But I don't want to let the normal users do everything root can do, so I can write a set user ID program that only lets them do this specific thing and not everything, and install that, and then they can run the program to do this one operation as root, but because the program is not written to do every single operation, they can only do that thing I allow. Questions about this idea of set user ID program and why we want to install some? Yeah. So the question is, could I just inject code in that program to do whatever I wanted? So probably the permissions on the program are going to be, if you remember user group other, right? Our user, it's going to be something like this. So you can't edit the program. So that's going to be our main defense against that. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah, but you bring up a good concern, which is that it really matters whether these set user ID programs have bugs. And this has been a source of lots of problems. And it's actually a much bigger problem with set user ID programs than typical places you write programs that need to do something, quote unquote, secure. And that's because we can run set user ID programs in all sorts of weird ways, because I'm just running a program, and I can run it in a way that you might, as an author of a set user ID program, not anticipate it. For example, did you know that you can start programs with standard out and standard out closed? How does your program handle that? Maybe not well. Well, if you have a set user ID program like sudo, it needs to handle that situation correctly, because any user can run it that way. And if it has a bad bug that does something it shouldn't do, they can trigger that bug, and that's going to run as super user. It's going to have access to every file on the system. You may know that, like, you can run a module load command to add, like, clang to your path on portal. You can, and that's kind of inherited by all the programs that you run. This is for set user ID programs. You can add other weird other things to your list of where to look for programs and make it so, for example, the ls command isn't ls anymore. It's a program you wrote. So if you're writing a set user ID program, you need to handle that. You need to handle that someone might have set the path, so when you look for ls, you find a program that is not really ls. And you also have kind of our standard concerns, like if you have memory corruption, if you have buffer overflows. You know, in a normal program, we just say, well, you're just doing stuff you could have done anyways. But in this case, if it's running as user ID 0, if that triggers code execution, you can write anything. So this means that if you're actually running set user ID programs like sudo, you need to be exceptionally careful to make sure your programs behave correctly, that they only let users do things they're supposed to do. And for this reason, I would not recommend writing set user ID programs. It is extremely hard to get right. If you want an illustration of how hard it is to get right, there have been arbitrary code execution vulnerabilities in sudo within the past year or two, even though it is obviously looked at very hard. They just had a bug where you could run the program with the environment set up in just the right way and trigger it to execute machine code that you specified. Just because it's easy to miss things. But in practice, these set user ID programs, they are really common, and mostly for not things like sudo, but for cases like, you know, mounting a USB stick, where basically we don't want to change the kernel, the core part of the OS, to allow, you know, mounting USB sticks, but not like unmounting the normal hard drive, right? That's something, you know, we don't want you to unmount the normal hard drive everyone's using, but when you'd be able to unmount the USB stick. But rather than changing the kernel to like be selective in this way, we just write a program and install it that handles checking, is the thing the user is asking me to unmount a USB stick or a normal hard drive? If it's a USB stick, do it, otherwise don't. Okay. So questions? Okay. And just as a term, this idea that we could run a set user ID program and do things we're not supposed to do, this is called privilege escalation. You know, basically that I have the permissions I'm supposed to have, but I can find some sort of bug that allows me to do things that are supposed to fail my permissions checks. And set user ID programs are one example of sort of one of the most common types of privilege escalations, that the set UID program is buggy. It allows me to do something I'm not supposed to be able to do. If I just trigger a bug in just the right way, and this gives me extra privileges, you know, lets me bypass permission checks in effect. Okay. So I've talked a bunch about kind of permissions at a high level and about this sort of tracking user IDs and group IDs. And we've kind of given a preview of the hardware mechanism for that, but that's going to be our next topic, is like what is actually going on in the hardware to make this possible, because we need some extra help. It's not going to be enough that just the OS, you know, does these checks. We need the hardware to prevent programs from sort of taking things into their own hands and bypassing the OS. And we gave you a preview of what that idea was, and that's this idea of privilege mode or kernel mode, where the OS code gets to run with extra access. So we're going to talk more about that. So let's think, go to like the big problem we're solving with permissions, is that you shouldn't be able to read each other's files. So we learned that the way that that works is that we have some permissions that are stored with the file, and when you open the file, the OS checks those permissions, and it just says no if they don't match. But a question you might have is, like, why do I have to have the OS access the file for me? Why can't I just access it directly? The hard drive is connected to my computer. Obviously, the OS communicates with the hard drive via some set of assembly instructions. I could put those same assembly instructions in my program. What's going to happen if I try? So basically, we want to allow the hardware and the operating system together to read files, but we don't want to allow anyone else to do it. So how can we implement that? I'm going to talk about what actually happens. But first, I'm going to talk about some ideas about how we could implement that. So one idea is that we could maybe allow your program to actually directly access the hard drive, but before we run your program, the OS tells the hard drive, hey, I'm running a program, here are the parts of the hard drive it's allowed to access. Another thing we might imagine doing is we could check your code before we run it and make sure it only accesses the hard drive in permitted ways, and if it doesn't, we just don't run your code. But the thing that we're actually going to do is that we're going to have the hardware be configured to only allow OS written code to access the hard drive. And we're going to just disallow all other code from doing it. And this is using the mechanism we previewed earlier of this kernel mode or privilege mode. So I'm mentioning these other designs, which are real things that you can do and that some OSs do. But sort of what we've settled on, kind of the simplest thing for us to implement, is that we're going to have the hardware implement this sort of binary decision that only the OS accesses the hard drive, nothing else. And the OS is going to give you selective access to the hard drive by letting you call the OS and having the OS access it on your behalf. Yes?
Is there any way to override that?
Is there any way to override that in your own system? Probably, but practically speaking, if you want direct access to the hard drive, the easiest thing for you to do is to write a device driver that does that and install it. Okay, other? Yeah. And so this scheme here, it's relatively easy for the hardware implement. We'll talk about what that implementation looks like. And it's the scheme that kind of avoids work for the OS. So this first scheme, where we just tell the hardware what parts of the disk to let you access, that's really complicated to implement, because we have to like check all the file permissions and like figure them out in advance. The scheme where we verify that your program's code only accesses the hard drive after doing checks, this is actually a thing we can do, and I've seen done, but it's not very common because it's pretty complex for the OS. And when it is implemented, usually it requires changing compilers to make the code checkable. But basically, if you want to do the scheme, you make the assembly code be written in a way where the OS can verify that it only does permitted things. So what we'll do in practice, because we want to run any code and not have to check it, is have this hardware help. And that hardware help is going to be this one bit register saying, are we in kernel mode? You might also see this referred to as privilege mode, or supervisor mode, or rig zero, or like 20 different other names. I'm sorry, we haven't standardized the names for this. I'm going to mostly use either kernel mode or privilege mode. And if that bit is set, we're in that mode. And if we're not in that mode, we'll say that we're in this user mode. And this one-bit register is going to be checked on certain operations, for example, talking to a hard drive. And that instruction is going to behave differently depending on the value of this register. So we have this kernel mode, and then the question is, how does the system set that register to 1 and set it back to 0 and set it to 1 again, right? We have to get this register in the right value depending what code is running. So the starting out is simple, as that we're going to boot the system in kernel mode because we need access to like load files and such. And whenever the OS is running your code, it's going to switch to user mode. Then we need some way of switching back to kernel mode, and we've previewed that mechanism already. That's going to be the primary way we're going to do that is a system call. We're going to find that there's some other occasions where we switch back to kernel mode, which we'll call, as a sort of general term, exceptions, which are different than Java exceptions. We'll call them hardware exceptions. And a way we can do this, the way we can think about this scheme is you have your program, the thing that we're going to load from disk, and it's going to run in this kind of limited interface based on it running in user mode. So it has access to the hardware directly, but it doesn't have access to all the features of the hardware. But you're going to need to want to do things where you need the help of the OS. So to do that, you're going to make what we'll call a system call. And that's going to run the kernel. And it's going to have code which is going to have access to the full hardware interface, which is going to have those extra privileged operations available because that kernel mode bit is set. And your program is going to be written to use a combination of the sort of limited user mode interface with handy things like move and add, and the system call interface with things like print to the terminal that you are not allowed to do directly. Okay, so questions about our conceptual division? Yes?
Just to confirm, the super user would still be in the user mode like hardware interface block. It just would with it.
The question is, if superuser would still be in that top block of applications libraries? Yes. So the only difference with superuser is that when superuser programs use the system call interface, the check here is just going to pass instead of not passing. Okay. Other questions? So let's talk about how we make system calls work. And an idea we might have is that we have our OS loaded and our program loaded. And a way we might do that is, well, you're going to call, our function to read a file in the system. And we can just do a function call. This might be the idea. But there's a problem with just doing a function call. There's a reason we're not going to want to do something that looks exactly like a function call. And that's that we want to let you run this read file safely function. That's great. That's the function you're supposed to call. But we don't want to let you run kind of the internals here. So in this example I have here, saying, okay, normally we call this read file safely. We say, oh, I want to read UC Rice private.txt. And it would check, can I access it? And then it would actually access the disk directly. And it has, and quite sensibly, we have a utility function to access the disk because I don't, you know, I wrote my OS in a way where I don't have huge functions, I have little ones. But there's a problem here that if I can just call a function in the OS, I could just call that read from disk function. So we want to very, very carefully restrict what functions programs can call in the OS. It's not just going to be any function call, it's going to be a very sort of controlled function call where the OS very explicitly decides what operations are allowed. And the big way it's going to differ from a normal function call is how we specify what function we're running. And it's because if we just specify it with an address, that's pretty bad. We don't want to run just any function. We only want to run safe functions that the OS author has said, this is how, what programs are supposed to do. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to have a special instruction that's kind of similar to call. That's going to jump to the OS, but it's going to have two big differences. It's going to switch to kernel mode, the important big difference to actually make, you know, us have access to, like, actually access the disk. And it's not going to go to a location that the syscall instruction specifies, because that would be unsafe. It's only going to go to a location that the OS configured in advance. So at boot, the OS is going to tell the processor, probably by writing to a special register or a special memory location, this is where system call should go, and the syscall instruction is going to jump there. It's not going to jump anywhere else. And we're going to keep programs from changing that location. It's just going to be something that can only be changed in kernel mode, so a normal program can't change where syscalls go. It's just configured at boot and stays that way. And so this is what the hardware does, is it just, we have this special instruction, jumps to location the OS specified, and switches to kernel mode. The rest of the operation is going to be in software, where we're going to have code the OS wrote that figures out what the program wants to do. And the way it figures it out is basically the same way as how a function you write in assembly figures it out. It looks at some registers for its arguments, figures out what those arguments means, and does something. And we have this extra constraint that we need to be very careful when we're doing this, that we only allow the program to do things it's supposed to do, which is easier said than done. Questions about our syscall, system call, special instruction and how it's used? Okay, so our basic pattern is that we have our program running in user mode. The program is going to make a request for the OS, and it's going to encode it in registers, just like we encode a function calls arguments in registers. We're going to run our special instruction on our department machines. That instruction is called syscall. Some other machines, it might be something else. That's going to start the system call handler in the OS, that thing that was configured at boot, and that's going to read those registers, figure out what the program wants to do, maybe actually do that thing, maybe return an error, and then typically it will go back to the program, you know, jump back to the program and switch back to user mode to finish that system call and let the program keep going. So this is basically a function call, except we have this extra switch to kernel mode and switch to kernel mode to run it and switch back to user mode to return. So questions about this timeline? And I'd like to make a brief terminology note. Depending who you're reading, you might see the term system call used to refer to this operation, or you might see it used to refer to this whole process beginning to end. I am sorry, we're not consistent about that. We have the same problem with function calls. Sometimes people say, oh, you do this function call, and they mean like the whole function call until it returns. Or sometimes they only mean the call instruction. And the same issue happens with system calls. So sometimes you'll read about making a system call and they only mean that syscall instruction basically, and sometimes they mean the whole process from beginning to end, no matter how long it takes. Okay. Questions? So let's go through with the specifics of how this works in Linux, just to have a concrete, very concrete example of how system calls are implemented. So we mentioned we had this special syscall instruction, and Linux has a calling convention, and this is basically how the assembly in the Linux kernel expects you to set things up when you make a system call. And if you remember your normal function calling convention, all this stuff is the same as the normal calling convention, and this too. But we have this added thing, which is sort of what function to run. So we have this thing called a system call number. And basically, rather than specifying a function address in the syscall instruction, because we can't do that, we put the index of the operation we want, and there's basically a table which says like 0 is going to be read, 1 is going to be write, you know, and we just have a whole bunch of different operations that we've assigned numbers to, and you look up the number, put that in RAX before you make the syscall instruction, and then the OS code is going to read that number and decide what to do based on it, and decide how to interpret the normal arguments. And then when we're done, it's going to return into RAX the return value of the system call. If there's an error, the way errors are returned, since we don't have exceptions, like they don't have like Java exceptions or something like that, is that we're going to return a negative number where there's a different code for each kind of error, like, you know, permission denied versus file does not exist. We'll have different codes that are returning RAX, for example. Questions about our calling convention? Yes. Do you have to specify what the error number is? So this is specified, this is set by the OS. So you won't specify it. If you want to print out the error number, you have to have look up what that means. There's a library function to do that. Okay. Other questions? So let's look at what using system calls can look like in assembly. So here I have a program that prints out hello world and exits. And to do that, we make two system calls. Our first system call is to write. And write has the system call number 1. That's the write operation, so I put that in RAX. And it has 3 arguments. It has where to write to, a pointer to the data to write, and how long that data is. So I specify all those in RDI, RSI, and RDX. And then I make a syscall instruction. Yes?
I was wondering, why are you putting the syscall number in RAX before the syscall? Why would you put it in like another register if not the return register?
Question, why am I putting it in RAX instead of some other register?
Yeah.
This is just the convention the Linux kernel developers have chosen. Okay. So there's code in the kernel that looks at RAX, so I can't use something else because they're comparing RAX. As for why do they choose the return value register, probably because they know you aren't using it for anything else, because it's going to be overwritten anyways.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, so that's our write operation. So I put my, what we'll call a file descriptor to specify write to standard out. I have a pointer to my string in RSI. I indicate the string is 15 bytes long and run the syscall operation. And if I were being good, you know, I probably should check error code. I have just forgotten to check the error code, but if I wanted to, I could do it after the syscall operation. That's where it will return to. Yes?
I answered my own question.
Okay. Then I have this program makes a second system call to exit. And you might be saying, wait, why am I not just returning? And why am I making a system call to exit instead? And there's a reason for that, which is that this is not main. This is something other than main. So here, I'm writing a program without the C standard library. So there's no main. The way main works is that there's some code in the C standard library that calls main. So you talked about crt.o. So basically has this start that calls main, then run the exit syscall if main returns. So it has code like this in assembly. I'm not running with crt.o. This is not using the C standard library. So I have to write that code myself. And if I just return, well, nothing called this start function. So there's nowhere to return to. The return address is invalid. It's going to crash in like segfault. So to avoid that, I have to tell the system to exit, and I make a system call to do that. Because what does the exit operation do? It runs other programs instead of mine. I can't do that myself. I need the OS's help. Yeah?
So by default, syscall takes in RAX, RDI, RSI, and RDX as variables, so then you just know what to do.
Question, how does syscall know what to do? How does syscall know what variables it takes? So we have this calling convention, and I have this list of arguments as for how many are used. Each different system call number has the set of arguments it needs.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, and in the OS, I mentioned there's sublocation that's set at boot. So we have our sort of location, the syscall jumps to. And in the OS, there's some code that basically like saves everything on the OS's stack and then does a table lookup and actually calls the right handler and then returns back to using a special instruction. Sort of special go back to user mode instruction instead of a normal return instruction. And I showed you kind of some system calls. So here are like a partial list of system calls on Linux. So we have system calls for like allocating memory, for creating a new process, running a new program. We'll talk later about why are these different system calls? Isn't that the same thing? Turns out on Linux, no, even though it might make sense for them to be. We'll talk about exactly why later. We saw terminating a process, reading and writing, and opening files, doing all the socket stuff. So these are all examples of different things that have system calls, and you can see that sometimes the system call might match up to functions you've actually used, and sometimes it's, you know, a different function than one you've actually accessed directly. We'll talk about more about how that works a bit. But first I want to talk about some system calls that work a little differently. And we saw one of them, which was exit. Exit like does something that doesn't match the pattern I showed you before. And also like read is going to be in the same, not match that pattern in another way. So let's talk about read first. So if I make a read system call to like get input from the keyboard, then sometimes what's going to happen is I might need to wait for that. And part of the system call is that the OS is going to stop running my program for a while and do other stuff. And then it's going to go back to the program and actually return. So quite commonly, you'll have a system call that won't be handled, all at once. Part of handling it is that the OS will switch away from your program and do other things for a while. And kind of a special case of this is that if I want to exit the program, the OS switches away from my program, not just for a little while until a key is pressed, but forever. Just never goes back. So system calls don't need to return immediately, don't even need to return at all. And that's fine. Questions? Are system calls not returning? Yeah.
So if you want to do something with like graphics on a computer in assembly, for example, you'd use a system call to say, do that, or is there?
So question, if I want to do something with graphics, I'd use a system call to do that. So we're going to have a model where all I/O involves making system calls, because that's our norm. The reality is that that's not always 100% true. Sometimes the OS can selectively give you access to I/O devices. But to a first approximation, yes. OK, so something you might notice, if you remember the sockets lab in CSO, one, you may have remembered, you called a function called socket, a function called accept, a function called read, a function called write. These are all, or maybe a function called receive, which is also a system call, or send. And you might say, okay, so I was making system calls, but I was doing that by writing like socket in C. But you just told me that the assembly for this doesn't look like the assembly that normally corresponds to that. Like when I write foo in C, this turns into some stuff with call foo, but it seems like when I write socket, this should turn into something with syscall. And that seems like a problem. How does that work? And the answer is, it does turn into something with a call socket. That is actually is what happens. But then how does a system call happen? Right? We learned that call socket can't run a system call. That's the normal call instruction. It's not syscall. The answer is that we have some library functions that wrap system calls. So I'll call system call wrappers. Sometimes you also see the term sort of system call stub. But these are functions whose purpose is just to convert from a normal function call to a system call. So for example, there's one for open that just wraps the open system call in Linux. And what it does is it sets the system call number. It happens that Linux has chosen a calling convention where all the other arguments are already in the right place. So that's all it needs to do. Then it runs the syscall instruction. And then it does some post-processing on the error code to put the error in a more convenient place in the special error no variable, if there's an error. So this is a function that exists because there's no actual way of directly writing the syscall instruction in C, but you can write a function call to assembly function. So we have these assembly functions that are written to you that do that syscall instruction and also set REX, which also there's no way of doing in C. And there's library functions like this for pretty much every system call in Linux and most other Unix systems. So for example, on Unix, you can use the open system call by calling the open function that's declared in UNI standard.h. And this turns into just a normal function call. We're going to move something into RDI and RSI, and then we're going to call open. And then that open function I just showed you is actually going to make the system call, actually going to run the system call instruction. Okay, so questions about our system call wrapper? Yes? Question, the file descriptor variable is what I was referring to, the error code.
It's like, RX. Input, and then we're checking if it's less than 0, so that would be like one of the cases where we had one of the negative numbers for error.
So the question is, if we enter this if statement, that's where we have one of the negative numbers returned? Yes. So something that I kind of maybe glossed over in this assembly code here is that on Linux, the system call wrappers don't actually return that error code directly. And what they do here is that they put it in this error no global variable. So we have basically this, we have if RAX is less than 0, set error no equal gets to be minus RAX, and RAX becomes negative 1. So it actually returns negative 1 in that case, but it put the actual error code in this error no global variable. Does that answer your question? As for why did they do that instead of just returning it, old history, I think. I don't think that's actually a great design, but it's what we're stuck with. Yeah, and so I have code here where I'm using that global variable to print out information about what went wrong. Other questions? Okay, so we also have our system calls, and if you want to know what system calls a program makes, there's a handy program called strace on Linux that is basically a specialized debugger that just prints out all the system calls a program makes. It works the way debuggers work, but it just has this fixed mode where it just skips to every system call and dumps all the variables. So you can see here, if I run my hello world program I showed you earlier, which made a write and exit call, you see there, write, exit. Those are the two system calls. And you might think, okay, so if I have a C program that does the same thing, like this C program up here, I'd end up with the same list of system calls. And the answer is not quite. That the C library does a bit of extra stuff. It's allocating some memory here. We're figuring out things about how the system deals with threads that the standard library needs to support. We're figuring out the name of this current program for error messages. We're also checking for dynamically linked library information. We're checking, are we outputting to a terminal or not? So there's a few extra steps that the C library does. It makes this not so hard to read, but if you want to know what a program's actually doing, strace is telling you. This is all the requests this program's making of the OS. We can see that this in the real world quickly gets maybe messier than you might expect because there's lots of things, libraries, standard libraries that you're probably using handle that aren't things that normally come up. Yes?
Would this be less complicated, like, in terms of what it's syscalled, if you made it, write to standard out, hello world instead of puts?
So if I change this puts to a write, would this be less complicated? I don't know. Other questions? Yeah, and actually, this is a statically linked example. So if I do the same with a dynamically linked program, I have even a few extra things going on. Remember I said that with dynamic linking, we load at runtime, that's done with a system call. Here it's opening up libc.sl. Because when it's set up the link, we said it loads at runtime, there it is, loading at runtime. Open up the file with the standard library, actually load it. So, yeah, so I guess questions about this before I move on? So, since we have these system call wrappers and such, another way we can kind of view this interface is that we have kind of this extra steps in between where we have a library interface and system libraries that are kind of actually the interface used. Because typically, you write programs using those functions in the library, some of which are system call wrappers, some of which are like printf, which are not just system call wrappers. We saw like puts in my prior example here. You know, this puts ended up doing a write system call and some other things. You know, it's implemented with system calls ultimately, but you know, that's not the way we're writing programs. We're using this higher level library interface that ultimately uses the system call interface. Yeah, even though we could use system calls, we generally don't. Okay, so. So something we talked about at the beginning of class was about sort of sharing memory. So with that in mind, let's say I have these two programs here running at the same time. What should happen when they run simultaneously? So here, my first program is loading at value from address 10,000 into REX, and my second one is writing, if you remember your x86, x64 assembly, this is the source, and this is the destination, so it's writing to the same place. What do we expect to happen in program A? What's going to be the value of REX? Give you a minute, check with your neighbor what you think. This should be a review of what we talked about when we talked about address spaces. So in your time, who thinks it's A, that we're going to always have 42 in program A as a result? That, you know, the initial value of REX of memory at 10,000, that's going to be the final value. How about B, that it's always going to be 99, the value that program B shoved in there? Who thinks it's going to depend on the timing or the program layout? Okay. Who thinks it could be either, or there could be a crash? Okay, something else. No clue. Okay. So with the OSs we're used to, the answer is always 42. We have what's called memory protection. That there's no way that the program B can access program A's memory unless we deliberately allow it. And I haven't done any steps to deliberately allow it here, so it's not going to be allowed. And we talked about kind of the way that that's implemented is that when two different programs are running, they have different sort of address spaces, different mappings. So when program A puts in 10,000, that's going to end up over here. When program B puts in 10,000, that's going to end up somewhere else. So we'll pick up on this next time and pick up on the question of, well, what happens when program B accesses that memory? How does that work?